and Enzo selling for 70 million. There's no explanation to that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's the magic of the auction somehow, you know? Two billionaires maybe fighting for it.
Welcome to the Classic Driver Talks, the place where we speak about everything that's happening in the automotive world. And our guest today is someone who knows a crazy market quite well, the auction market. Why do I say it's crazy? Because I think it's unpredictable. If that is true, we will find out with our guest today, Augustin Sabatier-Gara from Arme Sotheby's. It's much easier for me to say Gus, and I only know you by the name Gus. Welcome to our Classic Driver studio.
Thanks, JP. Thanks for having me today.
Before we jump into this vivid discussion about the market, which I'm very interested in because I can only learn, and for someone who is with over two decades of experience, I would like to hear your opinion about things. Please tell us a bit more about yourself.
I'm a French gentleman, grew up in Paris, and then I moved to Italy in 2004, where I worked as a mechanical engineer. And the last job I did was to develop clutches for GT and racing cars, such as Ferrari, Maserati, Lamborghini, Pagani, and other brands. And after that, in 2012, I moved to London to work for RM Sotheby's. And since, I'm still in London. So that's basically a very, very quick summary of what's my background.
I love the fact that you come from the mechanical engineering side and went to the more commercial side, which I think people sometimes say is unemotional, but I completely disagree with this, because if you ever visit an auction live, the tension in the room is really something super special.
It's probably one of the best parts of the job is that adrenaline during the auction and see how it goes, and you constantly try to match what you were planning of what would happen during the auction and what's actually happening in the room live. And is that client who was interested in that car, is he bidding? Is he not bidding? Is he going much above his limit that he told you about a few days ago? Like, it's all that. And it's literally on the spot. So it's very, very exciting. If you're into it, it's absolutely wonderful. It's probably, one of the very best part of the job.
I said in the beginning that the auction market, as you described as well, is sometimes unpredictable. And we saw some crazy results at auction for low-mileage Ferraris. I mean, Arme Sotheby's, in their sale in Florida this year, 2026, sold a LaFerrari for 6.8 million or 6.6 million, I was not so sure. A new record for the model. Was this unexpected?
I mean, we have to come back a little bit into the market. As we all know, the market has been from the, let's say, the 80s and the 90s, a very flat market for very niche, enthusiastic collectors. And it was very, very tiny, very isolated, if I may say. And then, obviously, you've got the bubbles of the 80s that broke in 91 and those phenomena that most of the people have forgotten, probably.
Yeah.
And then there's the starting point for me happens when you have the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy and the subprime crisis. That's where the people lost probably interest into the stock market in general, and start to probably look into, you know, different assets class such as cars and others. And you can see, if you look at, you know, data, you can see the market, the global market, the volume of transaction changed slightly from 2008, with a peak in 2015. Then it corrects slightly between 16, 17. It's like wobbling a little bit, but like not crashing, but correcting, let's say. And interestingly, it's the moment where less of investors came to buy cars, less of like, oh, if I buy this, how much it worth in few months, few years. The real collectors kind of came back in 17 and 18 into the market, which was really interesting to watch and to witness, actually. After that, Fairly quickly, unfortunately, we went into the COVID pandemic. During COVID, in a way, the market correct because on average, the market collapsed of 35%. But realistically, there was a lot of things happening because people were annoyed being in, you know, lockdown, etc. So people were spending a lot of time on watching what's for sale, what's this, what's that. And I think probably a lot of people who didn't buy cars in the last in the last 2 years before COVID probably end up buying cars during COVID or during lockdown because it's like, let's cheer up our moral, let's be excited, etc.
We saw this, by the way, also on the classic driver traffic. So the classic driver traffic spiked in that COVID period, and there was a real demand of using the time at home. This is quite going side by side.
There's a fairly good correlation with things. And then after the COVID, when the lockdown eased and towards 21, but especially 22, all of a sudden you had a clear reaction and a lot of people were buying cars.
Yeah.
We could see the evolution of pricing. So you talk about the LaFerrari, but just coming back to the F50, for example.
Yeah.
Before that, the F50 was 2 million, 2.5 million. That's where they were, you know. And all of a sudden, they moved to 3.5 million, 4 million, you know, like in a very short period of time, like in few, probably 6 months, you know.
Yeah. These were already big jumps.
Really big jump right there. So you have that kind of post-COVID effect where people are exciting, people were really, really enthusiastic about buying cars. And obviously, there's a focus on limited edition, you know, brands that do exist today. I think that there's a very distinguished enthusiasm between a dead brand and a brand that still produces cars.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference.
Do you see that as an advantage that you have a brand that still produces cars? Or has it influence actually because there will be no more cars under that brand name?
Well, funny enough, it reassured the buyer to have a brand that does exist and they can identify to. I think we could witness, really. Like, we look at the market. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. But, like, you can see that they can have that feeling of membership and, like, you know, sentiment d'appartenance, which is in French. It's not the, you know, membership's probably not the right word.
Yeah, like, you're part of a group. Like,
exactly. And we can see that that's one over the other factor. But coming back to that hypercar, like supercar, hypercar evolution, most of them are limited edition. The evolution of those models goes to turbos and hybrids and et cetera.
Yes.
And I believe that the fact that you can't see a very exciting future, even it's probably more exciting than what we think. Maybe there's a bit of like, hey, why don't I look like back, not that far back, but like back into what were those cars, how limited they were, how nice they are, etc. And we can see clearly that all the, what we call them, the F cars, so from the 288 GTO until the F80, so the supercar, so we call it, I've got the big five, I've got the big six, I've got the big seven, eight, nine, depends on whether you take the LaFerrari and LaFerrari Aperta to consider if you have the full set or not. But it's basically those cars are clearly driving the market. What happened, and a bit like, you know, there's those moments in time where, like, we spoke about Lehman Brothers, we spoke about the subprime crisis. Then, unexpectedly, the Bachmann Collection sells our dearest competitor early in the year. And the very big question when you have crazy prices you cannot explain. There's no explanation, no nothing about charity. Yes, there was super low mileage, unique spec, last car of the model, usually, etc. But it's not enough to explain, like, an Enzo selling for 70 million. There's no explanation to that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's the magic of the auction somehow, you know? Two billionaires maybe fighting for it.
But would you really say that's the reason?
No, I think there's no reason. Like, we try to identify what happened, actually, in that day. And it's a combination of factors, but at the end of the day, you can't really say in a very scientific way what happened, and that's the explanation.
It would be very interesting to know that. I mean, that would finding the code to success in auction, I would say.
Yeah, in a way, it would be cool. But what the question was after that is more reactive, is like, is this a sunny day or is it summer?
Yeah.
And you never know. And what was very interesting is to see right after there was, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I believe there was the Bachman Collection, right after there was Arizona.
Correct.
Then followed by Retromobile in Paris, then followed by, I believe, the auction Cavallino we had in Miami, and then we had combine Miami, Moda Miami, Amelia exactly. Island, etc., and eventually Monaco time, and we'll see now, you know, what's happening in Villa d'Este and obviously over summer.
Yeah.
But also what we see is even in the private sales market, you know, we know what's going on in the private sales market. We do a lot of them. And what we could see is like the confirmation, auction after auction, private sale after private sale, or sealed bid after sealed bid, that there's a clear switch on the pricing of those cars. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Obviously, not every single car can get a premium, you know, but they... limited edition, low mileage, perfect condition, possibly single ownership. There is a
color
a research color, but we come back to the color.
Yes.
Because in Monaco, if I don't know if we were to jump into that.
Yes, please.
We had a silver Enzo, so one of only nine Enzo.
Wonderful car, I liked it.
Delivered new in silver.
Yeah.
Wonderful car, but had 19,000 kilometers.
Yes.
So like question is, what is the weight? Is the weight of the color? Color makes the car, or actually the mileage is something that is affecting it. You also have another factors which we didn't talk about is the tariff in America.
Mm-hmm.
And as not, I don't know whether anybody knows that who is listening to us today, but to bring a car from Europe to America, it would cost only 2.5% of the value.
Yes,
to import the car into America. For a car that is over 25 years old. But the US president has decided, think about Chinese market and protectionism, not think about classic cars, and has forgotten us in a way, that he put a tariff of 15%,
mm-hmm.
Which on major cars that are worth several millions, it's a big, you know, a big tax.
Could be a big ticket, yes.
A big ticket. So what happened, the reaction to that is the isolation of the US market.
Yeah, so it becomes very an endemic market.
Endemic market where the supercars there then went up in value because you don't have to import them. And they kind of like took 15% increase in value naturally, plus the global effect of the market, etc. But that's all of a sudden you've got 15% more in your Enzo, in your SP2, in your Carrera GT, or etc. You know, so and also you have the fact that more and more we're interested into more modern cars is shifting. You can clearly see the generation shift. Before you could move a car, there was no homologation program on, let's say, a Ferrari 275 GTB or a Aston Martin DB5 or etc. So those cars could move easily from a continent to another one. They were the same.
Yes.
They were road legal everywhere in the world. The problem is now you've got, you know, European specification, US specification, Japanese specification, GCC, so Middle Eastern specification. And all of that makes very hard to move a car from a continent to another one, from tax perspective, homologation perspective, emission, rules, etc. So every single market start to isolate on their own, and that's why in the US market being, you know, large demand versus offer, supply, then prices are going up, and it's very hard to explain to clients, well, yeah, I know that car or that model worth XYZ in America, but actually in Europe or in the GCC area, so the Middle East, you can't get those price, and you can't move cars around, you know, and all the buyers who were very active, for example, in America.
Yes.
And, as you know, we had a really good Pebble Beach in 25. And in October, here in Zurich, we had a fantastic auction with Swiss Collection. It was almost impossible to transfer, and it was physically impossible to transfer the interest from America to that Swiss collection. Literally impossible. We had no U.S. buyers.
Yeah. So, Gus, would you say it's fair to say that at the moment, or at least at the last 2 years, to limit the time frame I would like to look at, that the car market has turned from a globalized market into a regional market?
Unfortunately, with tariff, yes, I would say that's probably the case. I believe that maybe the tariffs are temporary. When the U.S. presidents will change, they might be a way of at least ease them for any cars over 25 years old.
And that would make total sense, right?
Just like we have in Europe, in any case.
Yes.
Like, there's a reduced rate for you know, collectibles, let's say. And I hope that's going to, you know, smooth a little bit the things. It would not necessarily change the problem of homologation.
Yeah, that's always very tricky, huh?
So that's something that, unfortunately, that's existing. And
yes,
it's pretty unlikely to change. But we'll see how it goes. As we say, we can't predict it. So, but we're fairly confident, though, of like, it's funny. There's lots of external factors to limit the evolution of the market, but actually it's booming. So it's funny that.
This is what I find hard to understand. And also coming back to the point to predict, because, yes, we have the tariffs for sure. We have all the limitations about the homologations of markets. I agree on that totally. And still we're seeing super interesting prices on cars from the 2000s to modern new cars, in a sense, as well. But I find it a bit shocking that you see that, for example, a 250 short V-base has now the same value, specific short V-bases, like in an Enzo or a Ferrari.
For most of the cases, actually, they are more expensive than the short V-base.
Nowadays.
Even though the short V-base... and that's very interesting to watch and to see in the market is the all-time great.
Yeah.
You know, like a 250 short wheelbase, a Gullwing, you know, those like easily recognizable cars, they're actually fairly steady in terms of value. Short wheelbase, we sold, I don't know how many in the last, and we probably sold 7 of them in the last 2 years. And getting... always like, you know, plus or minus based on the quality of the car.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Overall, if you consider all the factors of each car, the quality of the restoration, the history, et cetera, you basically get kind of the same money.
Yeah, that's so, actually true. Also for the Gullwing, I mean.
Yeah, they're very stable.
Yes.
So,
besides, you have like a super special alloy, like you sold to the Klein Collection. That's something super extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely.
But things like, speak about the Klein Collection, which was really like a fantastic sale. I mean, that I was like frozen in front of the YouTube live stream.
There was a junkyard.
Yeah, the junkyard sale. So if you want to put metrics on the car market, that many try to put metrics on a car market, and I always, but that might be also my limited understanding of whatever metrics you're using, but I find it difficult to say, okay, this is now the metrics of the Gullwing. If you have like someone that peaked like the alloy one at the junkyard sale, how does it go into the calculation? I find it quite difficult to say. And the factor, you said it as well, that you can have bidders who, for emotional reasons, dare to want to have this specific car.
But they have that emotion on that day, on that moment.
Yeah, exactly. You cannot plan it.
3 months later, 3 months before, they're not willing to buy that model. They're not into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a story of like a few years ago, like 250 short wheelbase California Spider.
Yeah.
We have one of those in the sale. And the car doesn't sell on that day. And we sell it 3 months later to a gentleman who was attending the auction, but was focusing on another car.
Yeah.
And he didn't pay attention to the car Spider. We sold it the exact same price. So no discount 3 months later. But it was a question of moment, of attention, of like he was focused on a very specific car and ignored the rest. And that was it. So you sometimes can miss a sale like that. Or on the flip side, if stars are aligned,
yes,
you know, then it goes crazy. So that's why it's absolutely impossible to predict. So, I you know, I like scientific things. I'm a mechanical engineer, as we said
before.
That's
what I thought.
But I never really looked into how can we build a model to predict the, you know, the market, etc. I think there's some very skilled people doing it. I found it interesting as an exercise, but I think it's a lot more simple somehow. Like we knew when the you know, when the F50 market was very interesting. There's only 50 cars, US version.
Yes.
So we knew when the car would turn 25, US could import the European version into the US without having to do any homologation.
Yeah.
That was a fairly easy prediction, and it happened exactly as we said. But that's, we don't have to do a very complex mathematical model. And
true.
You know, that's very basic,
yes,
way of thinking. That could be one of the criteria you can use in the future, but this is limited by the tariff.
Yeah. Obviously, I mean, we will see what the future will bring in terms of this.
Yeah.
Nothing we can do about. It's the situation all market players are in at the moment. So in that sense, it also kind of like it's a fair game because it's the same situation for everyone. At RMS Sotheby's, do you have specific departments that try to predict things outside of the just mentioned F50 phenomena, which was very easy to say, okay, there's big demand in the US, 25 years, they can be imported without any hassle, that's for sure. But do you have like also, do they try to build models to analyze this, or is it really like still a people's business?
No, it's still a people's business. We've been, you know, I mean, the company has been operating in the market for over 40 years now, from restoration, which was the initial business. Not many people knows that. But it still carries on now, as not many know. We as a restoration workshop, we have won 9 times Best of Show in Pebble Beach, aiming for the 10th one this summer, hopefully. So we'll see how it goes. But like, that's part of the business that is actually the origin of the business.
Yeah.
And then it turned into an auction business that developed in more recent years into a global sales platform. We do obviously the public auction that anybody knows about and we're more famous for, but also we have a private sale, which declined in very, very various options of doing private sales.
Yeah.
It could be, you know, consignment with public viewing, like the guys on the website, like any dealers. It could be brokerage transaction, or it could be extremely discreet transaction, like targeted transaction. We get consignment, produce a document that promotes the car, but it goes to only 2 or 3 or 5 clients. If it does work, great. Doesn't work, we forget about it, you know. So we can do things, you know, really tailor-made for each needs, each level of exposure of each client, based on what they want, what they want to see, what they don't want to see. And it's also an evolving system. You can be super discreet at the beginning. You try your 2 or 3 or 4 clients you think about, and then it doesn't work. If it works, great, and it's fantastic, and it's, you know, the best results we can aim, and it's usually the case. But sometimes, you know, it takes more time. It's not the right moment. And you just go a bit more wider. You just bring the cars to events. You bring into Retromobile. You bring in the car on display at the ICE or whatever. And and then you got a bit more exposure, but it's not still not on the website on the, like, you know, wide angle, you know, of the market. So we go by step also the way we can promote a car privately, and we have also the famous sealed bid. They've been very successful for, let's call them, find me another one cars.
Yeah.
The white Enzo, only one.
Yes.
The made black Enzo, only one. The Fangio 300SL Roadster, there's only one because it's this car, you know. And those kind of cars have been doing super well in the sealed bid.
That's only for the super special ones, as you said.
We try to keep it. Sometimes we have some other cars, but we try to keep it to cars that you can't find anywhere else, you know, which give that premium. Like we sold, you know, the Senna, those 2 Senna Formula Ones. We sold the first DLS Turbo Singer. We sold lots of things through the sealed bid, which give the 2 things: is discretion of the amount of the transaction, because we don't publish if it's sold or not. We don't publish how much it's been sold for, but you still benefit from the leverages of the auction. So people are bidding and bidding again, etc. So the platform is quite interesting and it works. We've been very happy, and it covers an aspect of the market where people we're not sure. No, I don't want to go public at the auction. I don't want to do private sale. It could take 6 months or 8 months or 2 years to sell a car. I don't want that either. So there's kind of like hybrid between the two, and it suits certain clients. And we try to you know, cover that aspect of the market either.
It's very interesting to see how RM Sotheby's positions itself in this market field. And you are one of the big players in that game. I think it's interesting to understand the way auction house can also drive a market. Do you think you have the power to drive a market? Can you influence the market?
Well, it's not done on purpose in a way like we don't calculate, oh, we're going to drive the market on that model or etc. Okay. It's not done on purpose, but we see that, for example, the Formula One market, which is very, which is a very specific market, we created it completely. It was a dead market, no, just like only people who wanted to have a Formula One, like really, really racers that are very specific. They were buying and selling Formula One.
Yeah.
But in 17, what we did is we brought a 2001 Michael Schumacher car into a contemporary art sale, not a car auction. So it was New York contemporary art sale at Sotheby's in our head office. Mm-hmm. And the car was in the middle of contemporary art artifacts. So it was quite interesting to see that that car was at that time, I think we had a pre-sale estimate around $3.5 million. We sold it for $7+ million dollars.
And to a car person, do you know that? Or was it an art person?
At the end of the day was a car person, but lots of bidders were art people, actually. And the very same car then sold again in Monaco last year for, if I'm mistaken, about $80 million. And that shows you how this market between 17 and 25 evolved. But in the middle, we sold probably 20, 25 major Formula One, whether there are many Ferraris, but not only, McLarens, you know, great, great, great stuff. Also a Mercedes, ex-Lewis Hamilton, that got $80 million in Las Vegas. So that market of the Formula One, we have been driving it, and now we're quite focusing on it. We're not driving in the sense of like we don't have to create the valuation, but where we drive it is by trying to source the best pieces.
Yeah.
That's how you generate then the market. It's not like, oh, I wake up in the morning and I'm going to create a market, specific market on the Formula One. That will never work, by the way. But
so there's a strategy behind it as well, in a sense.
The fact that we saw it working well, now then we understood like we have to be really good at that.
Yeah.
And we try to identify where are the greatest cars in the world and just be ready when they are ready, you know. And by showing all the track records of what we've done in Formula One, I must say it's not that hard to convince people to come to us. And in recent time, we have some, and trust me, stay tuned. We have a lot of new things coming in. In the next 2 years, it's going to be very good on that side.
Since 1998, Classic Driver is the place online to find iconic classics like an Aston Martin DB5 or modern sports cars like the latest Porsche GT3 RS. At Classic Driver, you find offerings from the most important dealers, the most trusted auction houses, but also from private sellers. So if you're thinking of buying a new car for your collection or selling, head over to Classic Driver. Coming back about markets. So as you said, this was the F1 market was a very specific one, right? Mm-hmm. And I think very specialized collectors with that field of motorsport or even used cars in cliente programs, maybe, in a sense. And I think that's also a part that we have to look at, that nowadays with the F1 cliente program from Ferrari, for example, you can really use this one. It's not something super affordable for sure, but you have now a car where you have the old computers. And in our video about the Monaco Historique, we also were allowed to visit the F1 cliente program. And, you know, it's very fantastic to see this. This computer is HP computer for the season 98. Then you have the most smaller one computer, looks more modern
for the 2005 season and stuff like that. But actually, for every season, you have like your own computer standing there for each of the cars.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, and we said this also in that video on that you can find on YouTube, we also said that it's the magic of the V10s. It's just magical. So would you say it is very important not only to collect a car, to put it somewhere in storage, that you also have the chance to drive it?
It's clearly one of the drivers of the market. Is the capacity of a client to use his car, whether it's eligible to Mille Miglia, Le Mans Classic. Yeah. So those cars that are eligible to major events in the world, so Monaco Historique, Le Mans Classic, Tour Auto,
Goodwood.
We said the Mille Miglia, Goodwood, Colorado Grand, et cetera, et cetera. Those cars would always have a regular market. Why? Because there's always someone new coming in and said, I want to do the Mille Miglia, I want to do Le Mans, I want to do Monaco. And you need to buy an entry ticket. And the entry ticket is the car.
Basically. Yes, always.
So that's clearly a driver, and that's how obviously the Ferrari Formula One cars worth more than the McLarens, worth more than the Williams or the Lotuses, etc.
Sure.
Because there's a super well-organized program. I've been following personally that program since 2002.
Yeah.
I went first time to Finale Mondiale in 02 in Misano. And so I've been always very close to that program. And it clearly helps, you know, people to decide whether they want or not want to buy a car. They know it's super well-organized. They know it's friendly. It's actually it's more accessible than what we think.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you need to buy a Formula One that's worth several millions. That's true. But after that, it's actually very manageable in terms of cost and running costs and everything, like for what it is, you know, for what it gives you.
But what is the guess? What is the guess of a season?
It depends whether you stay on your continent doing the rounds, the even rounds on your continent, or you fly your car around the world doing, going to Fuji, going to Kota and coming back. And
going to Monaco.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's really, really related to whether you fly a car around. Most of the people, they are regional. So the US gentlemen, they use their car in the US and Europe in Europe and Japanese in Japan. Like that's mostly what's happening. And it's combined with the XX program and the 499 Modificata program, so as the Club Competition GT. So the whole Corse Clienti.
Yeah, it's one.
And they have the same mechanism. You know?
Yeah.
I think because there's many events around the world with great tracks, great atmosphere, very nice dinners, nice team to welcome you. Like, just to give you a very, like, I don't know if we have time, but like, to give you a very brief, like, synthesis of the program when you embrace it. You arrive at the airport. You get picked up. Hotels are taken in charge. Your car is ready. You don't have to think about the transportation. You don't have to think about the readiness of your car. You got probably in Formula One and XX, you've got between four or five guys dedicated to you in your car. You've got the full gears like helmets, overall, et cetera, et cetera. You even have a massage and physiotherapist to look after you after your session. You've got telemetry checking. You've got instructors, amazing coffee and food, obviously, around the world. And you have those instructors with the telemetry and the data, how to improve your driving and your braking points, And all of that makes you feel your work Scuderia Ferrari driver, you know. And that feeling is really cool, I think. It's really nice, and it's not complicated, you know what I mean? It's headache-free, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the way it's organized is very, very interesting to watch. And it's been, you know, for a long time there, and it's very successful. Like when you go to Finale Mondiale, which is the end of year celebrations, the last round of the older series, you can see that, I mean, I don't know how many, there's probably 25, 30 Formula Ones and 80 XXs, and I don't know how many... 499 Modificata, probably all of them, 30 cars, you know? And each car is running, unless there's a crash, but like, each car is running, there's no technical problem.
Yeah.
It looks like a very easy...
Way old machine.
Yes, exactly. And you can see that when you go and see the WEC and you see Ferrari working on their cars and being so successful.
Yes.
It's very, very interesting to see how it looks easy. I know it's very hard. There's a huge work being put into the program, But it's interesting the correlation between the two, between Corsica and the actual work, which is the World Indoor Championship, where the team works in such a, I don't know how to describe it. Like, it looks so fluid, you know?
Absolutely. So this was also the impression that we had when we were visiting them while they're doing the rest preparation for the demonstration run in Monaco. And I would highly suggest that this would should be, become part of the actual race in a sense. I don't know how they could do it, but it would be amazing that this wheel would be really become a race in competition. But this is exactly why, and now we spend back to the market situation, and you mentioned brands. We spoke about this in the beginning. You said there is a difference between brands that still exist, which has the question of trust, and also that you know you can go to someone in case.
Yeah, you feel there's a headquarter. There's some, there's a focal point.
Yes,
you know?
you're not lost. You're not depending on independent workshops and stuff like this. You can go. You have the feeling at least you can go there.
Yes.
What is the driver of Ferrari? Why? What does Ferrari much better than other brands to become this iconic and make people pay premium for cars? What is it? What do you think is the magic?
It's very hard because you have another brand, which is, there are three brands that are phenomenal, I think. It's Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, and Ferrari.
Like, you see Mercedes-Benz still in that?
Mercedes-Benz is the history. It's the, you know, it's the probably oldest brand, did everything from, you know, cars to trucks to whatever.
Yeah.
Has lots of world record, was super advanced technology, especially in the 50s with the W196 and et cetera. So it's a brand that has a lot to tell, a lot to say. It's still a very consistent brand with all the archive being in the same place. It's not like a brand like Maserati or Lamborghini that have been sold several times and the archive has been lost or partially lost and it's still there. You don't know. I think the consistency of Mercedes-Benz, it's still a very, very interesting and reassuring part of it. And it's their certification program is very robust. The archive is phenomenal. So it's I would not undermine it.
Okay, interesting. Because if I look at auction catalogs, I have to say that I don't see too many Mercedes-Benzes at the moment.
No, but when we have them, we have heavy duties.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, sometimes we sell like the W196 open or closed, like LaFerrari, LaFerrari Aperta is the same thing, you know.
But you know what I mean. Of course, as we mentioned so many times now that this Ferrari has this kind of magic around it. But
Ferrari is Ferrari. There's nothing you can explain. It's so hard. It's a combination of many things, I think, is the obviously the nature of Enzo Ferrari, the his personality, the way he puts the brand, the how Ferrari won everything in the early days and having that unique choice of engine with the V12 that at that time not many brands were using to race. Yes, there were some V12s in the Rolls-Royce world and some others, but like it was very specific for post-war racing. There's not many V12s. And obviously it makes the difference.
Yes.
I think those long run rallies, whether the Ferraris, they won everything, you know, whether it's the Targa Florio and Minamilia and Le Mans, etc.
Amazing racings.
And then become successful also in Formula One and starts to be like, when you look at Ferraris in the press conference in 1962, you basically have every single possibility you can. Like, you've got
crazy
formulas and Formula Ones and sport prototype and GTs and you name it, you know. It's the peak probably of Ferrari at that time in racing. It's and then obviously you've got less of a Ferrari presence, more into Formula One after 73. There's less presence in endurance until the car come back through the GT program, a little bit with the 333 SP and then the GT program, but then obviously finally the car, you know, Ferrari's back in work with the success we all know now.
What a celebration, you know, it was.
Phenomenal, three times Le Mans and World Championship last year. So that's, you know, how do you explain that? There's probably also an element of like, it's Latin, there's an element of like Italian culture, food and relax and drama and I don't know.
Beauty.
Yeah, it's just very hard to explain all those things that makes Ferrari so special and unique, I think.
Yeah.
But having said that, it's a very exclusive brand. When you go to Ferrari events, it has to be old Ferrari. You can't go to Ferrari. You can't, you know,
yeah,
almost can't go to Ferrari without having a car from the Fiat group or Stellantis group now. You know what I mean? So it's very exclusive.
I see that, yeah.
On the flip side, you go to a Rennsport reunion, and you I'm exaggerating, and don't be harsh with me when I say that with Porsche. It's, you can come with like a go-kart with a flat six on it, and you're accepted. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But this is also the beauty of Porsche, and I think this is also the power of Porsche.
Yeah, it's another model. I call it inclusive, exclusive. Yeah, for me, I see it like that.
And Ferrari is always, I don't know if it's fair to say, but Ferrari always, starting with Enzo Ferrari, they always kept distance to everyone, their drivers, their clients. Everyone was in a bit of a distance. It's just a thesis. I'm not, I don't can prove it. But Porsche was always like, okay, let's go racing, let's do this all together. And of course, definitely the market entry into the Porsche world is much easier.
Much easier, and it's inclusive. You show up to, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, but Luftgekühlt, sorry. Yeah. You go to Rennsport Reunion, you go to other Porsche events, and it's fairly inclusive. You're there, you're part of the family, and you jump in, you know. The Ferrari world is the other way around, but I don't think one is bad or one is good.
It's very just, good.
It's very different.
Yes.
And what Ferrari does very, very well, I think, is the fact that whatever Ferrari you have, there is an event for you.
Yeah.
There is always something, absolutely, either through the dealership or through Cavalcade Legacy Tour, Corse Clienti, XX Program, a club challenge. I forget all those programs.
Things. It's really like literally for every Ferrari model, you can find a specific event.
There's a specific event where there's a specific community and you build relationship, you build friendship. It's a bit like playing golf, basically, all around the world. And you drive your Ferrari all around the world. And whatever you do, you always find that kind of group of friends and have the same passion. And it can be called a Cavalcade or Legacy Tour, whatever. And a world premiere of the presentation of the new car. So they're very, very good at that, at offering so many options of, you know, experiences.
Absolutely, yes.
And I think that's probably the strongest offering that I know about. In a smaller scale, due to the number of cars, Pagani is doing kind of the same.
Yes, I think Koenigsegg is in a sense
and
as well.
And Koenigsegg that I know a lot less, that I'm very curious to know better, because I'm very curious about the technique. I want to know about that gearbox.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely.
I like to go and visit Christian von Koenigsegg and say, I'm a clutch guy, so I want to know how you did your gearbox.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us, how did you do it? I think there has been lots of discussion around Koenigsegg and the reliability that I cannot comment on because I don't have any proof of that. I just hear what I see. But I think, as you said, it's the small brands like Koenigsegg, like Pagani, and then you have between Ferrari and these two brands, you have Bugatti sitting with a very interesting offering as well.
Bugatti is a unique case either.
Absolutely.
You've got the Prua Bugatti, got the Artioli Italian, let's say, the Italian Bugatti and the, let's say, German/French Bugatti. So the Volkswagen era, now Rimac,
And we're seeing Orveron prices also stabilizing.
Yeah,
right?
It's a very interesting brand that is one of the very few that could really transfer from the pre-war to a proper revival.
I mean, we know many collectors that have both pre-war Bugatti and also Volkswagen era Bugatti, and of course in between the Adioli times.
And I think they're all completely different era, different style, different things. But at the end of the day, you still have the same DNA of being the best, the excellence on the technology.
Yeah.
So Prua Bugattis were the most advanced, probably together with Alfa Romeo.
Yeah.
I still have Alfa Romeo in my heart, sorry.
Yes, that's okay. I think
the Ferrari, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it totally would not, would slightly disagree.
But Bugatti has had that research of the absolute excellence.
Yeah.
And was very successful pre-war. had the same thing with the EB110 and has the same thing with the Veyron and the Chiron, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that, I mean, we all know that today to develop a hypercar, or a special car, it roughly you've got 3 years of research and development.
Yeah.
Bugatti, for the Veyron, they took over 7 years of research and development. When you know the cost involved, to be more than double that any other car,
yes,
it's mental. And you see the effort they had to put into it, because to reach those targets of 1,000 horsepower, 400 kilometers an hour, what people don't realize is a car can do 300 kph with the same tires, it's fine. But the tires has a deformation after a certain speed. And you create phenomena you don't know about when you are 200, 250, 300 kph. And at 400, it's a different
game.
It's different game.
Completely.
It's the analogy is the TGV, you know, the fast train we have in France, and the high-speed trains. They had the same problem. They create, at high speed, it creates vacuum.
Yes.
So the ballast, the little stones, would just been sucked and hit the bottom of the train and create big damages, because when you're at 400 kph, it's a drama.
Yeah.
And Bugatti, when they had the development of the Veyron, that they had the same kind of challenges, let's say. And it's, I think that makes, that has a great future. For me, that generation of, you know, Veyron and Chiron, we don't realize that, but it's a landmark in history. 400
Absolutely.
kph on the road.
Yes.
1,000 horsepower. Now it's normal. Yeah, my car is 1,600 horsepower and mine is 1,200.
Exactly. No,
but it's the first one to get to
the
that
first
point.
One, and also the first one you can buy in a small series, in a sense. And this is coming also there to the question. My feeling is, I just would like to have your opinion about this. I think that Veyron, even a standard 16.4, is undervalued at the moment, in my opinion.
Completely. Completely, it's a rare car. If you see the number of example builds based on the version and Grand Sport Vitesse, and our regular ones, it's still a limited edition car whatsoever. Every car is almost unique because of the specification, the color scheme, etc. And I agree with you. It's still a landmark in history. And Bugatti is a great brand. Is, you know what I mean? The criteria are all there for a great future.
I think so too. And I would be surprised if not this market will take off as well. I mean, we saw this with the large meeting of Veyrons at the Las Vegas Concours, where they had this big gathering of US-based Veyrons. And definitely I see this car is something, I would not say a sleeper, because it's therefore the prices are too high in the end. But what is very good is, a friend of mine said to me once, and he is very close to the brand Bugatti from his mindset, and he said the Veyron in the beginning had one big issue. The first one was it took too long until the first announcement in Geneva, I think it was, and then until you saw the first production cars. Yeah. And the cars were never seen on the road. And he made this famous sentence. He said, if you don't see a car, the car doesn't exist in the public eye.
Yeah, man, it's true. It has to be. It's the case. And sometimes we have that. That's one of the things. Sometimes we have cars that are exceptional.
Yes.
But they've been such an isolation in terms of like, what they have done, nobody knows about the stories, and the market just doesn't cope with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird thing, because in a way people want to buy things that are easily recognizable, because it makes you feel good. When you're at the dinner, you say, oh, I've got a DB5, or I've got a Jaguar E-Type, or I've got a Ferrari 250 Lusso.
Yes.
Everybody knows what it is, you know, somehow. If you're more modern, I've got an Enzo. You know?
Yep.
Everybody knows what it is. So it's an easy and comfortable conversation to have. But on the flip side, people want unique things to be different to
of the crowd.
So that's the maturity of the collector. But firstly, you buy things that are easily recognizable. Then you select more, and you buy things that nobody has, because you've been there, and you show up to your concourse and your events or your rally, and everybody has got the same cars as you. But then what makes the difference? But I've got a Formula One, I've got this,
yes.
Or I've got the Le Mans winning car, I've got the Mille Miglia winner, I've got the Monte
Carlo
winner.
That's what I'm thinking. You know? You go then, if once you find your brand that you think you can, you want to go higher and deeper in it because you're exactly, it's like a bit with the yacht guys. You want to have the longest yacht, right?
Yeah, so, but you won't have a unique one either.
A unique one, exactly. So, and then we go back in history. And so this is what we see in the classic driver market. Obviously, we see definitely now a high interest in cars, as we said, from period 2000 onwards to modern. But then sometimes out of the classic driver marketplace, we push a model that is very rare and very special. It's a 50 or 60s cars, and we see quite interest in it. And also from young people, the generation that might not be in touch with these kind of cars because they were too far away from them, always it's the story and the history about it. The provenance is a very important part also in building a market and being in the market. And it's exciting to see what will come. And that brings me to the point, Gus. Do you see a car at the moment? We spoke about the Veyron, but I mean it in a more radical way. Do you see a car at the moment that is horrifically undervalued?
Well, it was the case a few months ago before that all what happened in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
But now it's keeping up. Like I thought, like, let's call it like a year ago or less than a year ago, I thought the 550 Barchetta is very undervalued.
Yes.
It's
in terms of numbers, in terms of design.
It's rare. It's a 12-cylinder front engine, manual, and it's a Ferrari. It ticks lots of boxes.
Yes.
And I don't think the roof is an issue. So I thought that's weird that the market is, you know, penalizing that car. And by the way, now it's going up like crazy.
Yes.
There's another car which was really sleeping in the market, which is the 599 GTO. But now it starts to keep up. It's still not yet where it should be, I think.
So that would be a good car to jump on.
It already went up.
Yes.
But I think it's not yet there, knowing what's happening with the A12 Competizione and the F12 TDF, which rightly gets what they deserve in the market, but I still think the 599 GTO is a rare car.
Yes.
And if you want to be even more specific, you need to buy 599 SA, so the open version of the GTO. Not many people think it's a GTO, but it's truly...
It is.
it's a GTO engine. It's a GTO in every single aspect of the car, but it's open and it's rare. So I think those... those cars that are like, you know, not completely looked after.
Yeah.
I think in a much more approachable way, you know, you've got different generation of Ferraris. You know, you've got the 355 with the 456, and then you have, you know, the Modena is more with the Maranello, in somehow. And then you've got the 430 with the 599 and the 458 with the F12, et cetera, et cetera. Between 8 and 12 cylinders. I think the generation, which is specifically the first one with the dual clutch, which is the F12 on one side and the 458 on the other side, that generation is super pretty, whatever version you take. You can take a regular 458, a Spider, a Speciale Aperta. You can take an F12 or TDF. Whatever you take, it's an absolutely gorgeous car.
Yeah,
it's very, very usable. It's reliable, it's well finished. I think that generation of car has a long, long future, and it's also the start of the Atelier and tailor-made, and so you can have fun with finding a car that has been, you know, it's fairly unique in terms of specification.
This is what I like at the 599 GTO, because you find absolute amazing specs on that car. So I totally agree that it's a car to watch. For the F12,
even regular cars, you have to go on TDF or 458 Speciale, you know what I mean? Like,
no, you don't have to, and I agree. But I think the reason for the F12 is also being the last Pininfarina designed car helps also a lot to make it special.
Yeah.
And this comes to the closing now, because it really shows that there are so many different factors in creating value, in what drives the market, that I think
it's I can stick to my entry comment saying it's not that easy to predict the auction house market.
My mentor said to me in my early days, said, ce n'est pas une science exacte. So it's not an exact science.
Exactly, you know? Yeah. That's very nice. That would be a great T-shirt.
I've been, you know, for my brain has been like set like this,
yeah,
from the early days of you know, me working in that business, and I think he was right.
I couldn't agree more. Gus, we ask all our guests to profile themselves by the cars they choose, not they own, but the cars they would like to own, and we ask you to have a look at the classic driver market.
Mm-hmm.
Where we have now, I think, around 11,000 cars for sale. Of course, very special ones, and that's what we always try to find. What would be, when you last time were on Classic Driver, browsing the market, what would be the three ones that stuck to your mind?
Two for sure. I'm not sure if I have three.
Okay.
Two that really I was like, that's interesting. One is a Fanan GT we just spoke about in a very dark gray color that
yeah.
I found like super, super attractive. And it's still a dream for me. I can't afford it, but like I aim for, you know.
I'm sorry that we just created the open Pandora's box on the 599 yeah. GTO.
It's probably I'm going to follow that dream. Like the yes. more I can maybe afford it, the more it's going up. So it's always like a, you know, endless
yes.
thing. The other car that I think it's been a car that has been always weird in the market.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a car that I really believe in. And we come back to the concept more of the theory of what Ferrari DNA is there's a Daytona Spider
yeah.
for sale, which is one of the real car, one of the 120 and change cars built, like 123, 22, whatever
yeah.
it is.
I think.
And it's a 12-cylinder, 4-cam, 6-carburetor, manual, gate shifter, you know. If you tick all the what you want on a Ferrari, you want a V12, tick the box. 4-cam, tick the box. Torque tube, tick the yeah. box. Have a shifter, tick the box. Open car, front engine, like a limited edition.
Yeah, here
you
we
tick
go.
A lot of boxes.
a
know?
Lot, a lot.
And I can't remember on top of my head the asking price, but call it between 2 and 2.5 million.
Yeah.
You so get, it's a lot
yeah.
for what you get.
Yes.
And the software works nicely.
Absolutely. This, and the sound is great.
Sound is amazing.
Amazing.
It's rare.
Yes.
And it's a very nice car to drive. You can do long run, you know, travel with it. You've got luggage space. You know, when you think all of that, like,
yeah, it's crazy.
I'm like, is it still there? Like, we talk about, like, you know, versus, you know, younger siblings of the Ferrari brand.
I think that's a very good choice. I will definitely look good. I saw the Daytona. I saw.
It's funny that the Daytona Spider market, they kind of like wobble between yeah. 2 million and 3.5 million and come back and come back and come up and down and up and down. And for they are very, very robust car. Like a Daytona is a very strong yes. car. It's reliable. If it's well sorted by the yeah. right guys, there's no problem with yep. you know having it and do long run. Like I would go London down to Puglia with it, like yep. no problem.
Oh.
And that's always interests me. Like why like it?
You know what I think? What the reason could be that owners who have an original cars are always facing: is it original or is it one of the?
It could well be, but now I think that market that there's a big cleanup with Ferrari Classic Day, you know, like I think that issue was the problem probably yeah. 20 years okay. ago, but now with Classic A, I think it's yeah.
but then we
it's
see
a non-issue.
I'm sure we see the market stabilizing on that one.
Yeah, I just think it's a car that anybody could have. You could be young. It's an easy car to drive. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
like I believe in that. There's some obvious things like super rare color 8-cylinder Ferrari or whatever. Like, yes, yeah, cool. There's a blue Scotia 430 Scuderia right now. Amazing, but like, there's already so much hype on it. Like, you know,
don't believe the hype, someone said.
Yeah.
I mean,
but no, it's cool to have those cars, but I think it's a car that is a slightly older, like a Daytona, is probably more usable on a daily basis.
Good point, yeah.
You know?
Interesting, yeah.
I mean, I won't go into details, but I've got two Ferrari of different era, one of the late 70s and one of the mid 2000s.
Yeah.
Love both, but the older one, it's the car that I probably, it's such a usable car.
Yeah.
You jump in the car, you park it in the street, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to worry at any kind of miles you put into the car. I drive it up and down across Europe. Like I drove it like from Veneto area down to Rome for the Antara Concours, go and visit Ferrari, then went to Riva, went to Brescia, went to Monte Carlo, back to Mugello. Like I did 2,000 kilometers with that car in the last month. That's without thinking, and the first thing I want to do is to drive it back to London.
Yeah,
you know.
But what is the car? You just mentioned a 70s Ferrari.
It's a 365 GT4 2+2, nice. Which is the first version of the, you know, 400 and 412.
Yeah.
And that works. gives you probably 80% of the Daytona experience without spending the money of the Daytona. So I should not say that, but like
we keep that as a secret.
It's heavier and not as pretty. I agree. It's a bit ugly, but I love it. It's so ugly that it's probably it's pretty. Actually, it's actually not that bad when you look at it. The Fioravanti design. It's a Fioravanti design.
Yes,
and you've got lots of things that are quite interesting. But what I mean by that is when I drive my 599 and I've got a GTE car, so a Hunting GTE Evoluzione, it's a fantastic car. But 620 horsepower on the B roads, honestly speaking, you're not really having fun. You're always like, oh, it's careful, and the car is wide, it's big, etc. You're having fun on the motorway at 220, 250. But where can you drive that? You know, you don't have many occasion to drive that fast. To enjoy the whole potential of the car, bringing on the racetrack right now is probably not the right thing to do. So at the end of the day, it's more usable to drive those, you know, 60s, 70s Ferraris, even 80s.
Yeah, interesting.
Probably. It requires a bit of maintenance, but when you know how to, you know, where to go, it's not the end of the world.
You need to drive them. That's the most important part.
The more you drive it, the less you have to think about it. So.
And Gus, keep on driving, not only markets, but also your cars.
But that's my number one thing. You know, I started as a collector. I had my first classic car when I was 14.
Really?
So
was it?
A Citroën De Chevaux.
Nice.
AZU, so utility car, so the van, you know, the truck. That was a car that my great-grandfather bought new, and we always kept it, and my grandmother gave it to me.
Lovely.
So that's still in the family, and it's actually mine, not family. Yeah. Mine.
To make that point clear.
Exactly. So I grew up with, you know, buying cars that I enjoy, that I can use for events. Every single car has a job.
Yeah.
And those cars, they go from, you know, Citroën De Chevaux and little Fiat Panda 4x4 that I use in the mountains in the summer. I got a Fiat 500 because my mom who used to drive me at school with a Fiat 500. So I bought one, but I bought an Abarth 595.
Obviously.
Or 1964.
A bit more fun.
Exactly. And then Burton Coupe Alphas, which is probably the best entry ticket to the collector world, I think, together with the Pagoda. I think those are the two cars that I would advise to someone who's the first buy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reliable, eligible, safe car with, you know, disc brakes all around and things like that. So like a Burton Coupe or a Pagoda, I think those are the two cars that I really encourage people. If you don't know anything about our community,
start
with that. It's cheap enough. It's good enough. It's great fun. It's still like, you know, iconic brands, whether it's Alfa Romeo or Mercedes-Benz. You've got a lot for what it, you know.
Definitely.
For what you get.
Yes.
And then it goes for, you know, most of the people knows me for my XK120 that I drive at Le Mans and many other places.
On ice, for example.
On the ice, I drove it everywhere.
Yeah.
My black XK, it's my wedding car. It's
very close to you.
It's probably the last car I would sell.
Yeah.
I don't sell cars, by the way. I don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Can you teach me?
I know someone. His name is Gus. He works for Irish Sotheby's. You can ask him.
Can you introduce me?
Yeah, I will. He looks very similar to you, actually. You could be twins, I think.
No, but thank you also for sharing this, because that's something that's very important. Yes, we are interested in markets as well, because you don't want to necessarily lose money on a buy in a car, for sure. But one thing, which is also a classic driver, very important to us, is that we share the love for motor cars. And that's what we do. And I get often asked, what do you think? Is that a good investment? And so, and then my answer is always, because I cannot predict it, and my answer is always, if you interested in a car or interested in purchasing a car, and you can imagine yourself going down a sunny road on your own and having a great time, go for it. Because this is the best investment you can do. And if the other investment, the financial one, the monetary one, didn't work, it will not hurt that much, because you made a great investment in enjoying driving. And I think that's very, very important.
It's absolutely true. Buy what you love. Like, look, I bought together with some of the members of my family a 512 BB carburetor.
Yeah.
And I bought that in 15, and we, versus today's value, overpaid.
No? Yeah.
We never get that money back. If I sell it today, I will never get the money back. But it's been 12 years. It's with us. I drive it. I enjoy it.
Yes.
It's a wonderful car. That's another undervalued car, by the way. It's
I was just asking about it, to be honest, because it's crazy how undervalued these fantastic driving machines are. It's unbelievable.
The BB is funny, because it's fairly rare when you look at it. Every single model has its own production, you know, but like, it's a very usable car, more than what we think, despite it's a mid-engine.
Yes.
You can put lots of luggage when you know how to do it with the soft bags and etc. So I use it to drive with my wife, and we go and go in Piemonte and have some wine tasting or truffle eating. Or it's a very, very usable car, and the sound is amazing. It's just like, you know, something that people don't. I think the thing is to come back to buy what you like and don't make it as a pure investment. People don't drive their cars enough. We talk about those super low mileage cars. I mean, they don't drive their cars.
No.
I mean, I put probably 50,000 kilometers to most of my cars, you know.
Yeah.
And they all drive regularly. I try to have a reason why to drive them. And I said, if I do that trip, that I just did, I took the 365 down, and then I went back to London and took the Fauna out, and then I took the Deux-Chevaux when I was in the countryside, used the Panda in the mountains. Like, you try to make sure you use them on all those phases of your life, because when you buy something you don't like and the market collapses, you hate it 1,000 times more.
Absolutely.
But if the market collapses, like it happened on the BB when I bought it, I just use it and having fun, and I just love it. You know. So it's not a problem, I think, and I would encourage most of the people to do the same. You know, buy what you like. Really, really do that. That's the most important thing, and use it.
That's the second thing. Use them.
Use them.
Go out and drive.
Yeah.
And share the passion.
And that whole thing of limited edition, okay, buy a limited edition as a pure investment, but buy the sister car
and drive it. Exactly. If you have the means, do that.
Yeah.
So, Gus, thank you very much. I really like this shift from sheer market view to the more emotional part of our field and of our community. And I think that's something that's very, very important, eagerly important. So, on the one hand, you want to understand also the market a little bit, but it's all about emotion in the end as well, and also about your personal enjoyment that you can take away and create great memories. So, Gus, thank you very much for joining us in our Classic Driver Talks. That's highly appreciated. And thank you for joining us as well. And if you like what you saw, please give us a subscription to our YouTube channel and follow us on our social media outlets like Instagram and TikTok. And also, we would like to mention that this show is presented by the Classic Driver Marketplace. That means this is the place where you find the coolest cars online, for sure. So if you plan to buy a car that you want to create great memories with, stop by at classicdriver.com and have a look at the marketplace to find the car that will make that happen. Thank you very much all for joining. Leave us a lot of comments. And if you want to share your ideas and visions and tell us what we can do better or what you liked, both is absolutely welcome. Thank you very much all for joining. And Gus, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, JP. Very great.